Lecture 3 by Rudolf Steiner in the book Human Values in Education, a lecture cycle. Lecture 3 is Walking, Speaking, Thinking, given on July 19th, 1924. You may have gathered from my remarks during the past 2 days that a fundamental change takes place within a human being at every stage of life. Today, certainly, modern psychologists and physiologists also take this into consideration. They, too, deal with these life changes. First, the period before the change of teeth, then up to puberty, and again from puberty into the 20s. These changes, however, are more profound than we can discover through ordinary observation, which does not go far enough, however excellent one's means may be. We must go further and examine these changes from the perspectives required by spiritual science. You will hear much that is already familiar to you, but now you must go into them more deeply. Even when a child enters this world from the embryo, looking at it externally, and adapts to the outer process of breathing, even then the child is not yet received physiologically by the outer world. This requires the natural nourishment of the mother's milk. At this stage, children are not yet nourished by what meets them from the outer world, but by what comes from the same source as the children themselves. People today study the substances that they encounter in the world more or less according to the physical chemical properties alone, and they do not consider the finer attributes that they possess through their spiritual essence. Everything today is viewed in this way. We do not condemn such methods. On the contrary, we must recognize them as appropriate. Nevertheless, the time came when people were concerned only with the external aspects of phenomena. This was impossible in earlier times, but now we've reached a point of extreme externalization. For the sake of comparison, phenomena are observed today somewhat like this. People say, quote, "I see death and dying. Plants die, animals die, human beings die," unquote. But we must ask whether dying, the passing of the various forms of life around us, is the same for all three kinds of living beings, or whether this is merely an external appearance. Consider a few comparisons. If I have a knife, there is a big difference between cutting food with it and using it to shave. In either case, it's still a knife, but the qualities of knife must be differentiated further. This is often ignored today. The ways that a plant, animal, or human being die are not differentiated. We encounter this phenomenon in other areas as well. There are those who, in a sense, want to be natural philosophers, and because their aim is to be idealistic, even spiritual, they assert that plants very likely have souls. They try to ascertain, in an external way, the characteristics of plants. That seem to indicate certain soul qualities. For example, they study plants that tend to open their petals when approached by insects. The insect is caught, having been attracted by the scent in a plant such as the Venus flytrap. It snaps its petals closed and the insect is trapped. This is thought to be a soul quality in the plant. But there is something else that works in the same way, and it can be found in all sorts of places. A mouse approaches it and is attracted by the smell of a dainty morsel. It begins to nibble, and the mouse trap snaps closed. If we were to use of the same thought process as that used in the case of a plant, we might say that the mouse trap has a soul. This kind of thinking, although legitimate in certain situations, never leads to conclusions of any depth, but remains more or less on the surface. If we desire true knowledge of the human being, we must penetrate to the very depths of human nature. We must be able to look in a completely unbiased way at phenomena that appear paradoxical compared to an external view of things. Moreover, we must consider everything that together constitutes the entire human organization. First of all, like all earthly beings, especially those of the mineral kingdom, as human beings, we have a physical organism. Nevertheless, we must clearly distinguish between our physical body and our etheric organism, which we have in common only with the plant world, not with the minerals. A being having only an etheric organism, however, cannot experience feelings, nor acquire an inner consciousness. For this purpose, human beings have an astral organism, which we have in common with the world of animals. This might seem like an external organization, but in these lectures you will see how inward this can be. In addition to this, human beings have an I-being, capital I, which cannot be found in the animal world. We alone possess this among earthly beings. What we are speaking of is in no way merely an outer intellectual pattern. Further, when we use the term ether body or life body, this is completely unrelated to the outmoded terms life force, vital force, and so on as used in natural science. Rather, it is the result of observation. If we study a child before the change of teeth, for example, we see that development depends mostly on the physical organism. The physical body must adapt gradually to the outer world, not all at once, even in the crudest physical sense. The physical body contains what we bring from the spirit world before earthly existence, and it cannot immediately assimilate the material of the outer world, but receives specially prepared mother's milk. A child must remain closely connected, so to speak, with another being of like nature, growing only gradually into the outer world. This process of growing physically into the outer world is indicated by the appearance of the second teeth around the seventh year, when the child's physical organism completes the process. During this time, when the organism is concerned mainly with forming the skeletal system, children are interested in only certain things in the outer world. They are interested only in what we might call, quote-unquote, gesture, or everything related to movement. Now consider the fact that initially a child's consciousness is dreamlike and shadowy, perceptions are vague, and they light up and only gradually gain clarity. Fundamentally, however, the fact remains that in the time between birth and the change of teeth, a child's perception adheres to everything related to gesture and movement. It does so to the extent that at the very moment when they perceive a movement, they feel an inner urge to imitate it. This is a definite law of development in human nature, which I would like to describe for you. While growing into the physical earthly world, inner human nature is developing in such a way that it proceeds initially from gesture and from the differentiation of movement. Within the organism, speech develops from all the aspects of movement, and thought develops from speech. This law has deep meaning and forms the basis of all human development. Everything that appears as sound or speech is the result of gesture, mediated through the inner nature of the human organism. If you turn your attention to the way a child not only learns to speak, but also learns to walk, placing one foot after the other, you can see how one child steps more strongly on the heel, and another more on the toes. You can observe children who, while learning to walk, tend to bring their legs well forward, and how others are more inclined to hold back, as it were, between steps. It is very interesting to watch a child learning to walk. You must learn to observe this. And it is even more interesting, although it is given less attention, to see the way a child learns to grasp and to move the hands. There are children who, when they want something, move their hands in such a way that the fingers move as well. Others keep their fingers still and reach out to grasp without moving their fingers. Some children stretch out their hand and arm, keeping the upper body motionless. Others immediately allow the upper body to follow the movement of the arm and hand. I once knew a child who was very small, and when his high chair was placed at a distance from the table and some dish he wished to reach, he would, quote-unquote, row himself toward it. His whole body was moving. His whole body moved with every movement he made. This is the first thing to look for in a child. The way a child moves reveals the innermost primal life urges. At the same time, a tendency to adapt to others appears in children's movements as they try to perform the same movements as the father, mother, or other family member. This principle of imitation is revealed in gestures and movements. Gesture appears first in human evolution. In the special human constitution of physical, soul, and spiritual organisms, gesture is transformed inwardly into speech. Those who can see this know without doubt that children who speak as though sentences were being hacked out of them are the ones who place their heels down first. On the other hand, children who speak in such a way that sentences run into one another... On the other hand, children who speak in such a way that sentences run into one another tend to step more on their toes. Children who take hold of things more lightly with their fingers tend to emphasize vowels, whereas those who tend to stress the consonants also tend to use the whole arm when grasping. We receive very definite impressions of children's potentials from the ways they speak. Understanding of the world through the senses and thought is also developed out of speech. Thought does not produce speech, but the other way round. This is the way it is for the cultural development of humanity as a whole. Human beings spoke first, then thought. So it is for children. First they learn to speak and articulate out of movement. Then thinking arises from speech. We must therefore see this sequence as something important. Gesture, speech, thought, and thinking. This is all especially typical of the first period of a child's life up to the change of teeth. Gradually, children grow into the world during their first to fourth years of life, and they do so through gesture. Everything depends on gesture. In fact, I would suggest that speaking and thinking occur unconsciously for the most part. They develop naturally out of gesture, even the first gesture. Therefore, we might say, from the first year to the seventh, gesture dominates the life of a child. Gesture in the broadest sense of the word, which lives in a child as imitation. As educators, we must keep this firmly in mind, because up to the change of teeth, children take in only what meets them as gesture. They shut themselves off from all else. If we tell children how to do various things, they really do not hear or take any notice. But when we stand in front of them and demonstrate a way to do something, they are able to imitate the action. Children act according to the way I move my fingers, or they look at something just as I look at it, not according to what I say. They imitate everything. This is the secret of development in children up to the change of the second teeth. They live completely through imitation of what comes to meet them from outside as gesture in the widest possible sense. This accounts for the surprises we experience when teaching very young children. A father came to me once and said, quote, "What can I do? Something terrible has happened. My boy has been stealing," unquote. I said, quote, "First, let's find out whether he really steals. What did he do?" unquote. The father told me that the boy had taken money out of the cupboard and bought candy, which he shared with the other boys. I replied, quote, "I presume that the boy has often seen his mother taking money from that cupboard before going shopping. It is quite natural that he would imitate her," unquote. This was confirmed, so I said, quote, "That is not stealing. It is a natural principle of development in the boy before the change of teeth. He imitates what he sees. He must do so," unquote. In the presence of children, therefore, we should avoid doing anything they should not imitate. This is how we educate them. If we tell them not to do something, it has absolutely no influence on the child before the change of teeth. It might have some effect if you clothe the words in a kind of gesture, perhaps saying, "Now you have done something that I would never do." This is a kind of disguised gesture. It comes down to this. With our whole humanity, we should fully understand how, up to the change of teeth, children are imitating beings. During this time, there is indeed an inner connection between children and their surroundings and everything happening around them. Later on, this is lost. This may sound strange and paradoxical to many today, because they are unable to think correctly about spirit and think only in abstractions. Nevertheless, it is true that the relationship between children and gesture has an innate religious quality. Through the physical body, children are given over to everything that has the quality of gesture. They cannot do other than yield themselves to it. Later on, with our soul, and even later with our spirit, we give ourselves to the divine, even to the external world, as once again spiritualized. This is what children do with the physical body when they bring it into movement. They are completely immersed in religion, with both their good and their bad qualities. Also present in a child's physical organism is what remains with us as soul and spirit later in life. Consequently, although children may not understand the inner causes of what they see, they experience something immoral when they live in close proximity to a surly, bearish father who is likely to give in to rages, who is often irritable and angry and expressing uncontrolled emotions in the children's presence. Children perceive, however unconsciously, the moral nature of such outbreaks, so that they not only have the outer image of the gesture, but they also absorb its moral significance. If I make an angry gesture, this passes in to the blood system of the child. And if these gestures occur frequently, they find expression in the child's circulation. The physical body of children is organized according to the way I behave in their presence, according to the kinds of gestures I make. Furthermore, if I fail to provide love and understanding when children are present, if, without thinking of them, I do something that is suitable only at a later age, and if I am not constantly on the watch when they are nearby, it may happen that they lovingly get into something that is unsuited to their tender years, but belongs to another age, and the physical body will be organized accordingly. Those who study the whole course of a person's life, from birth to death, keeping in mind the requirements I have mentioned, will realize that children who are exposed to things suitable only to adults, and who imitate such things, will later on, after the age of about 50, suffer from sclerosis. We must be able to examine such phenomena in all their ramifications. Illnesses that appear in later life are often merely the result of educational errors made during the earliest years of childhood. This is why an education based on a knowledge of the human being must study human nature as a whole from birth until death. To be able to look at a person as a whole is the very essence of spiritual science. You also discover how strong the connection is between children and their surroundings. I would go so far as to say that children's souls go right out into their surroundings. They experience those surroundings intimately and have a much stronger relationship to them during later periods than during later periods of life. In this sense, children are still very close to the animal, except that they experience things in a more spiritual way, and in a way more permeated with soul. An animal's experiences are coarser and cruder, but animals, too, are related to their environment. This is why many phenomena of recent times remain unexplained. People are unable to go into all the details involved. There is, for example, the case of the quote-unquote calculating horses, which have made such a stir recently. These are horses that do simple arithmetic by stamping their hooves. I have not seen the famous Elberfelder horses, but I have seen the one belonging to Herr von Osten. This horse performed addition. For instance, von Osten would ask the horse for the answer to 5 plus 7. Von Osten would begin to count with 1, and when he got to 12, the horse would stamp its foot. It could add, subtract, and so on. Now, there appeared to be a young professor who studied the matter and wrote a very interesting book about it. In this book he claims that the horse was able to see certain little gestures made by von Osten, who would always stand close to the horse. In his opinion, when von Osten counts up to 12 and the horse stamps, this is because of a very slight gesture from von Osten when he reaches 12, and the horse notices this, stamps his hoof. He believes that it can all be traced back to something visible. But then he asks, why can't you see this gesture made so skillfully that the horse sees it and stamps at the number 12? The young professor continues by saying that the gestures are so slight that, as a human being, he cannot see them. This conclusion might lead us to think that a horse sees more than a professor. But I was unconvinced. I saw this wonderful, intelligent horse, the clever Hans, standing next to von Osten in his long coat. I saw, too, that in von Osten's right pocket he had lumps of sugar, and during his experiments with the horse he handed it one lump after another, which aroused a feeling in the horse that associated sweets with von Osten. In this way a sort of love was established between the man and the horse. Only when this is present, only when the inner being of the horse is merged, as it were, with the inner being of von Osten, through the flow of sweetness between them, only then could the horse calculate, since it really did receive something, not through gesture, but through von Osten's thinking. He thinks, quote, 5 plus 7 equals 12, unquote, and by means of suggestion, the horse takes up this thought and even has a distinct impression of it. One can actually see this happening. The horse and master are, in a way, merged in feeling one into the other. They impart something to each other reciprocally, while united through the medium of sweetness. So the animal has this finer relationship to its environment, and this can be stimulated externally, in this case by means of sugar. In a delicate way, children have a similar relationship to the outer world. It lives in them and needs to be addressed. Kindergarten education should rely on the principle of imitation exclusively. Kindergarten teachers must sit with the children and do only what they wish the children to do, so that they simply have to imitate the teacher. All education before the change of teeth must be based on this principle. After the change of teeth, this changes, and a child's soul life is completely different. Children now perceive more than single gestures. They see how gestures work together. For example, previously, children had a sense of only a certain line. Now they have a feeling for coordination or symmetry. A feeling is awakened for whether something is coordinated, and the child's soul acquires the ability to perceive formative qualities. Once this perception is awakened, an interest in speech is simultaneously awakened. During the first 7 years of life, there is an interest in gesture and everything related to movement. During the time between 7 and 14, there is an interest in everything related to image, and speech is primarily pictorial and formative. After the change of teeth, children's interest shifts from gesture to speech, and in the early school years between 7 and 14, it is best to work with everything involved in speech, and above all, through the moral element behind speech. Before this age, children have a religious attitude toward the gestures they encounter in the surrounding world. Now that their religious feeling has gradually refined into a soul experience, they relate in a moral way to everything they encounter through speech. So during this period of children's life, we must work with them through speech. And however we work with them, we must do so by means of unquestioned authority. When I want to communicate an image expressed through speech, I must do so with the assurance of authority. I must be the unquestioned authority for that child whenever I want to invoke an image through speech. With the smaller children, we want to show them what to do. Now we must become the human pattern for children between the change of teeth and puberty. In other words, there really is no point in reasoning with children at this age, trying to make them see why something should be done or not, just because there are good reasons for or against it. This goes right over children's heads. It is important to understand this. During the earliest years of life, children observe only the gesture. Likewise, between the change of teeth and puberty, they observe only what I, as a human being, am in relation to them. At this age, children must learn, for example, about morality in such a way that they naturally accept the authority of the teacher, so that anything designated good through speech is deemed good by the children. Whatever this authority designates as bad, the children should also consider bad. They must learn that everything their teacher does as the authority is good. What the teacher does not do is bad. Relatively speaking, the child feels that if the teacher says something is good, it is good. If the teacher says something is bad, it is bad. You will not credit me with a view that maintains a principle of authority as the single means of salvation, given that I wrote Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, German Die Philosophie der Freiheit, 30 years ago. Nevertheless, by knowing the true nature of freedom, we also know that between the change of teeth and puberty, children need to be faced with an unquestioned authority. It is part of human nature. Everything in education that ignores this relationship between children and the unquestioned authority of a teacher is bound to fail. Children must be guided in everything that they should or should not do, think or not think, feel or not feel, according to what flows to them by way of speech from the teacher. Thus, at this age, there is no point in approaching children through the intellect. Everything must be directed toward the life of feeling, because feeling is receptive to images, and children at this age are constituted in such a way that they live in a world of pictures, and they have a sense of welding separate details into a harmonious whole. This is one reason why morality cannot be presented to children through precepts or by saying that they should do this or not do that. It just doesn't work. What does work is when children, by the way we speak to them, feel an affinity in their souls for what is good and a dislike toward what is bad. Between the change of teeth and puberty, children are aesthetes, and we must make sure that they experience pleasure in the good and displeasure in everything bad. This is the best way for children to develop a sense of morality. We must also be sincere inwardly in the imagery we use with children. This means being permeated to the core of our being by whatever we do. This is not the case when one stands in front of children and immediately experiences a slight sense of superiority, imagining that one is much smarter than the children. This attitude destroys all education. It also destroys any feeling for authority in the children. How then should I create an image out of what... Read that again. How then should I create an image out of what I want to communicate to the children? I have chosen an example that illustrates this. We cannot speak to children about the immortality of the soul as we would to adults. Nevertheless, we must convey some understanding of it, and we must do it in a pictorial way. We should build up a picture such as this, which might well take up a whole lesson. We explain to the children what a butterfly's chrysalis is. Then we say something like this. Later on, the finished butterfly flies out of the chrysalis. It was inside all the time, but it was not yet visible. It was not yet ready to fly away, but it was already present inside. Now we can go on and tell the children that similarly the human body contains a soul which is invisible. At death our soul flies out of the body. Here the only difference between a human being and a butterfly is that the butterfly is visible and the human soul is invisible. This is how we might describe the soul's immortality to children, in order to give them a true image of immortality, one that is especially suited to their age. Whenever you are with children, however, you must avoid any sense of being smart or a philosopher, and you should have absolutely no thought that whereas you may understand the truth of immortality, the children are naive or simple and need the image of a butterfly creeping out of its chrysalis. If you think in this way, you cannot really connect with the children, and consequently they will get nothing at all from what they are told. The only way is to genuinely believe in the picture yourself. But you must never want to be smarter than the children, but instead stand in their presence just as full with belief as they are. How can you do this? As students of spiritual science, we know that an emerging butterfly is a true image of the immortal human soul, which is placed into the world by the gods. We have to imagine that the gods inscribed this picture into the world, that is, the emerging butterfly being an image of the human soul's immortality. We see the higher processes abstracted in all the lower stages of the process. An imponderable relationship arises between you and the students, and the children make real progress in their education as long as you do not get the idea that they are ignorant and you are clever. You must stand before the children aware that this is a fact in the world, and that you are leading them to believe in something that you yourself believe with all your heart. This is how moral imponderables continually enter the educational relationship. This is crucial. If we are clear about this, the whole focus of our studies leads us to see how we find the right approach to education, one that is truly instructional and teaches. For example, how should children learn to read and write? There is really a lot more misery connected with this than people typically imagine, though intellectuals are far too superficial to see it. We recognize that learning to read and write is necessary, so it follows that children must be driven to learn reading and writing at all costs. Just consider, however, what this means for the child. Once children become adults, they are not the least inclined to place themselves in the children's position and imagine what they experience as they learn to read and write. In today's civilization, we have letters, A, B, C, and so on. They present themselves to us in definite forms. The children have the sound ah. When do they use it? To them, this sound expresses an inner soul experience. They use this sound when faced with something that invokes a feeling of wonder or astonishment. They understand this sound. It is connected with human nature. Or they have the sound eh. When do they use this sound? They use it when they have the feeling that something has come up against them. They have experienced something that encroaches on their own nature. If somebody hits me, I say eh, and it is the same for the consonants. Every sound corresponds to an expression of life. Consonants imitate an external world, and the vowels express inner soul experiences. Today's study of human speech or philology approaches only the first aspects of these things. Scholars who devote themselves to researching language have given much thought to the course of human evolution and the possible origins of speech. There are two theories. One represents the view that speech may have arisen from soul experiences in much the same way that this takes place in animals, albeit in the most primitive form. Moo being the expression of what a cow feels inwardly, and bow wow the experience of a dog. Thus, in a more complex way, human speech arises from an urge to express inner feelings and experiences. In a somewhat humorous vein, this has been called the Bow Wow theory. The other view comes from the supposition that in the sounds of speech, people imitate events in the outer world. It is possible to imitate the sound of a bell or what takes place in a bell, ding dong, ding dong. This is an attempt to imitate what takes place in the outer world. It is the basis for the theory that everything in speech can be traced back to external sounds or events. It is the ding-dong theory. So, we have these two opposite theories. It is certainly not my intention to make fun of this. In fact, both theories are correct. The bow-wow theory is right about the vowel element in speech, and the ding-dong theory is right about the consonants. By transposing gestures into sounds through the consonants, we learn to imitate outer processes inwardly. In the vowels, we form the inner experiences of the soul. In speech, the inner and the outer are united. Human nature itself is homogeneous and understands how to accomplish this. We take children into our primary school. Because of their inner organization, they have become beings who can speak. Now they are suddenly expected to experience, parenthesis, I use the word experience deliberately, weighing my words, not recognize, parenthesis, a connection between astonishment or wonder and a demonic sign, the letter A. This is completely alien to them. The children are expected to learn something that they experience as completely remote and to relate this to the sound ah. This is outside the comprehension of young children. They feel it as a kind of torture when we confront them with from the very beginning with the forms of the letters as used today. We can, nevertheless, recall something else. The letters that we use today were not always present. Let us look back to the ancient people who used a pictorial form of writing. They used images to give tangible form to what was spoken, and those pictures were certainly related in some way with what they were intended to express. They did not have the kinds of letters we use, but images related to their meaning. Until a certain time, the same could be said of cuneiform writing. In those times, people still had a relationship to phenomena, even those fixed in a definite form. We no longer have this relationship, but with children we must return to it. Of course, we shouldn't do this by studying the cultural history of those ancient people, falling back on forms that were once used in picture writing. Rather, as teachers, we must use all our educational imagination to create the pictures we need. Fantasy or imagination is absolutely necessary, since we cannot teach without it. Likewise, it is always necessary to speak of the importance of enthusiasm or inspiration when dealing with some characteristic feature of spiritual science. It never gives me any pleasure, for example, when I enter a class in our Waldorf school and notice that the teacher is tired and merely teaching in a certain mood of weariness. We must never do this. We simply cannot be tired, but must always be filled with enthusiasm. When teaching, we must be absolutely present with our whole being. It is wrong to be tired when teaching. Tiredness must be reserved for some other time. It is essential for teachers to learn how to give full play to fantasy. What do I mean by this? First of all, I evoke in the children something that they have all seen at the store or some other place, a fish, for example. Then I get the children to draw a fish, and I even allow them to use colors so that they paint as they would draw and draw just as they paint. I then have them say the word fish, not saying the word quickly, but separating the sounds. Fish. Then I lead them to say only the beginning of the word, fish, F, gradually transferring the shape of a fish into a sign that is somewhat fish-like, while also getting them to say F. And there we have it, the letter F. Or I have the children slowly say wave, picturing for them at the same time a wave. Again, I ask them to paint this and have them speak the beginning of the word W, and then I change the picture of a wave into the letter W. Continuing in this way, I allow the written characters to emerge gradually from the painted drawing or drawn painting, as indeed they actually arose in the first place. I do not bring the children to a stage of civilization with which they still have nothing in common. Instead, I guide them so that they are never torn out of their relationship to the world around them. To do this, there is no need to study cultural history, even though today's writing did arise from pictorial writing. We must only allow free play in our imagination. For then we bring the children to the point where they can form writing from their drawing and painting. Now we must not consider this merely as ingenious, clever new method. Excuse me, let me read that again. Now, we must not consider this merely an ingenious, clever new method. We must value the fact that the children unite themselves inwardly with something new to them, while their soul activity is constantly stimulated. They do not grow into it when they are forced and always entering unfamiliar relationships with their surroundings. The whole point is to work on the inner being of the children. What do people usually do today? Maybe it is already somewhat dated, but not long ago, people gave little girls, quote-unquote, beautiful dolls, with real hair, with pretty faces, with eyes that close when the dolls are laid down, and so on. Modern society considers them beautiful, but they are hideous, because they show no artistic qualities. What sort of dolls are these? They are dolls that cannot activate a child's fantasy. Now let us try something different. Tie a handkerchief so that you have a figure with arms and legs, then make eyes with blobs of ink, and perhaps a mouth with red ink as well. Now a child must develop imagination to see the human form. This kind of thing works with tremendous living force on children, because it offers them the possibility of using fantasy. Of course, we must do this ourselves first. But the possibility must be provided for children, and this must be done at the age when everything is play. This is why all the toys that do not stimulate fantasy in children are so damaging to them. As I said, today those beautiful dolls are somewhat outdated because now we give monkeys or bears to children. Excuse me. Nor do such toys provide an opportunity for developing an imagination related to the human being. Suppose a child runs up to you and you offer a bear for the child to cuddle. This sort of thing clearly shows how far our society is from being able to penetrate the depths of human nature. But it is remarkable how children, in a perfectly natural and artistic way, can form an imaginative picture of this inner side of human nature. In the Waldorf School, we have shifted from the ordinary methods of teaching to what we may call, quote, teaching through art, unquote. We never begin by teaching children to write. Rather, we allow them paint as they draw and draw as they paint. We could even say that we let them splash around, which involves that sometimes tiresome job of cleaning up the classroom afterward. Tomorrow I will speak of how we lead from writing to reading. Apart from painting and drawing, however, we guide the children as far as possible into the realm of art by letting them practice modeling in their own ways, without suggesting that they should make anything except what they want to make out of their inner being. The results are remarkable. I will mention one example that shows how something very wonderful takes place in the case of older children. At a relatively early age, our children between 10 and 11, a subject in our curriculum, is the study of the human being. At this age, children learn how the bones are formed and built up, how they support one another, and so on. They learn this in an artistic way, not intellectually. After a few such lessons, the children have gained some perception of the structure of the human skeleton, the dynamics of the bones, and the nature of their interdependence. Then we move to the crafts room, where they model plastic forms, and we observe what they make. We see that they have learned something from their lessons about the bones. Not that the children imitate the forms of the bones, but from the way they now model the forms, we perceive the outer expression of an inner flexibility of soul. Before this, they have already advanced far enough to make various kinds of small receptacles. The children discover how to make bowls and similar things all by themselves, but what they create through the spontaneity of childhood before such lessons is very different from what they model afterward, provided they have truly experienced what was intended. To achieve this, however, our lessons on knowledge of the human being must be given in such a way that their essence enters the whole human being. Today this has become difficult. Those who have paid as many visits to art studios as I have, observing the way people paint and sculpt and carve, know very well that hardly any sculptor today works without a model. They need a human form in front of them before they can sculpt it. To the ancient Greek artists, this would have made no sense. Of course, they had learned the human form at the public games, but they truly experienced it inwardly. They knew out of their inner feeling, a feeling they embodied without a model. The difference between an arm that is stretched out and an outstretched arm with the forefinger extended as well, and they embodied this in their works. Today, when physiology is taught in the conventional way, models or drawings of the bones are placed side by side, the muscles are described one after another, and no impression is offered concerning their reciprocal relationship. At our school, when the children see a vertebra of the spinal column, they recognize its similarity to the skull, and they get a feeling for the metamorphosis of the bones. In a lively way, they enter directly into the various human forms and thus feel an urge to express it artistically. Such experiences go right into life. They do not remain external. It is my earnest wish and my duty as leader of the Waldorf School to eliminate from the classroom, whenever possible, everything of a scientific nature that is fixed, including textbooks written in a rigid scientific way. I value science. No one could value it more. Such studies may be pursued outside of school if so desired, but I would become very upset if I saw a teacher standing before a class holding a book. When teaching, everything must come from within. This should be self-evident. How is botany taught today, for example? We have botany books based on a scientific view, but they do not belong in any classroom in which the children are between the change of teeth and puberty. The perception of what sort of literature a teacher needs must grow gradually from the living educational principles I will speak of here. We are indeed concerned with the mental attitude of the teachers and whether they can relate to the world in soul, spirit, and body. If they possess a living relationship, there is much that they can accomplish with children between the change of teeth and puberty, because through this method they can become the naturally accepted authority. The important thing is to get into and experience matters in a living way, bringing to life everything you have experienced in this way. This is the great fundamental principle that must become the foundation of education today. Then one's connection with the class will arise automatically, along with the imponderable mood and feeling that needs to go with it. Rudolf Steiner's answer to a question. Question: some adults seem to have remained at the imitative stage of childhood. Why does this happen? Rudolf Steiner. At any stage of human development, it is possible to remain in a fixed state. If we describe the various stages of development, including the embryonic stage in today's survey, and continuing through the change of teeth and on to puberty, we cover periods in which a fully developed human life can be formed. Recently, the general trend of anthroposophic development made it possible for lectures to address therapeutic or curative education, with particular reference to specific cases of children whose development was either retarded or in some way abnormal. We then took the step of showing certain cases that were being treated at Dr. Ita Wegmann's clinic. Among these, there was a child who was almost a year old and about the average size for a child of that age. However, this child's physical body had remained at the embryonic stage of approximately 7 or 8 months. If you were to draw an outline of the child with only an indication of the limbs, which were somewhat more developed, and show the exact form of this little boy's head, then looking closely at the drawing, you would not have the slightest idea that this boy was nearly a year old. You would think it the picture of an embryo, because this boy had in many ways retained an embryonic structure after his birth. Every stage of life, including the embryonic, can be carried over into a later stage. The different phases of development, as they follow one another, are such that each new phase is a metamorphosis of the previous, with something new added. Consider exactly what I said about the natural religious devotion that children have toward their surroundings up to the change of teeth. You can see that this changes into the life of soul, as well as a second attribute, the aesthetic or artistic stage. It happens with many children that the first stage is carried into the second, which then remains poorly developed. But this can go even further. The first stage of physical embodiment can be carried over into each of the others, so that attributes of the original stage appear in all the later stages. Even to superficial observation, it doesn't need to be very obvious that an earlier stage has been retained in a later one, unless it doesn't show up until particularly late in life. Nevertheless, it is a fact that earlier stages are carried into later ones. Consider the same phenomenon in a lower kingdom of nature. A fully grown and developed plant usually has a root and a stalk with cotyledon leaves, followed by green leaves. These are then concentrated in the calyx, the petals, the stamen, and the pistil, and so on. There are plants, however, that do not develop as far as the blossom, but remain at the stage of herbs, and other plants in which the green leaves remain fixed with merely rudimentary fruit. Notice, for example, how far the fern remains behind the buttercup. In a plant, this does not indicate abnormality. Human beings, however, are of a species that forms a complete natural order, and it can happen that throughout life one remains at the imitative state or requires an authority figure. In life, we are dealing not only with people who remain at the imitative stage, but also with those who remain essentially at the stage that develops fully between the change of teeth and puberty. In fact, there are many such people, and for them this stage continues into later life. They cannot go much further, and the attributes that should develop in later years can do so only in a limited way. They remain at the stage where they look for the support of authority. If such people did not exist, there would be no tendency today to form sects and the like, because sectarian associations are based on the fact that their followers are not required to think. They leave the thinking to others and follow their leaders. In certain areas of life, however, people remain largely at the stage of authority. For instance, when it is a matter of forming a judgment about something scientific, people do not take the trouble to investigate it themselves, but ask for the conclusion of an expert or specialist who lectures at universities. This is the principle of authority. In the case of those who are ill, the principle of authority may be carried to extremes, though this may be justifiable. And in legal matters, for example, no one today would consider forming an independent judgment, but seek the advice of a lawyer who has the necessary knowledge. Here the perspective is that of a child of 8 or 9, and the attorney is probably not much older. When a lawyer is asked a question, a law book is generally consulted, and once again we have an authority. So it is certainly true that each stage of life can enter a later one. The Anthroposophical Society should really consist only of those who are outgrowing authority and who recognize only the principle of true insight. This is little understood by people outside the society who continually assert that anthroposophy is based on authority. In fact, the exact opposite is true. The principle of authority must be outgrown through the kind of understanding and discernment fostered by anthroposophy. The important thing is to grasp every scrap of insight we can get hold of to pass through the various stages of life. The end of Lecture 3.